Presently he heard ambulance noises. Wailing from street, plus much bustle, people coming and going. A blanket was put over him up to his armpits, tie removed, collar loosened. "Better now," Mr. Tagomi said. He lay comfortably, not trying to stir. "Career over, anyhow," he decided. "German consul, no doubt, raise row higher up. Complain about incivility. Right to so complain, perhaps. Anyhow, work done. As far as I can, my part. Rest up to Tokyo and factions in Germany. Struggle beyond me in any case." I thought it was merely plastics, he thought. Important mold salesman. Oracle guessed and gave clue, but... "Remove his shirt," a voice stated. No doubt building's physician. Highly authoritative tone. Mr. Tagomi smiled. Tone is everything. Could this, Mr. Tagomi wondered, be the answer? Mystery of body organism, its own knowledge, time to quit, or time partially to quit, a purpose which I must acquiesce to. What had the oracle last said to his query in the office as those two lay dying or dead? 61. Inner truth. Pigs and fishes are least intelligent of all, hard to convince. It is I. The book means me. I will never fully understand. That is the nature of such creatures. Or is this inner truth now, this that is happening to me? I will wait. I will see. Which it is. Perhaps... it is both. That evening, just after the dinner meal, a police officer came to Frank Frink's cell, unlocked the door, and told him to go pick up his possessions at the desk. Shortly, he found himself out on the sidewalk before the Kearney Street station, among the many passers-by hurrying along, the buses and honking cars and yelling pedicab drivers. The air was cold. Long shadows lay before each building. Frank Frink stood a moment, and then he fell automatically in with a group of people crossing the street at the crosswalk zone. Arrested for no real reason, he thought. No purpose. And then they let me go the same way. They had not told him anything, had simply given him back his sack of clothes, wallet, watch, glasses, personal articles, and turned to their next business, an elderly drunk brought in off the street. Miracle, he thought, that they let me go. Fluke of some kind. By rights, I should be on a plane heading for Germany, for extermination. He could still not believe it. Either part, the arrest and now this, unreal. He wandered along past the closed-up shops, stepping over debris blown by the wind. New life, he thought. Like being reborn. Like hell is. Who do I thank? Pray, maybe. Pray to what? I wish I understood, he said to himself as he moved along the busy evening sidewalk by the neon signs, the blaring bar doorways of Grant Avenue. I want to comprehend. I have to. But he knew he never would. Just be glad, he thought, and keep moving. A bit of his mind declared, and then back to Ed. I have to find my way back to the workshop down there in that basement, pick up where I left off, making the jewelry, using my hands. Working and not thinking, not looking up or trying to understand, I must keep busy. I must turn the pieces out. Block by block, he hurried through the darkening city, struggling to get back as soon as possible to the fixed, comprehensible place he had been. When he got there, he found Ed McCarthy seated at the bench eating his dinner. Two sandwiches, a thermos of tea, a banana, several cookies. Frank Frink stood in the doorway, gasping. At last, Ed heard him and turned around. "I had the impression you were dead," he said. He chewed, swallowed rhythmically, took another bite. By the bench, Ed had their little electric heater going. Frank went over to it and crouched down, warming his hands. Good to see you back, Ed said. He banged Frank twice on the back, then returned to a sandwich. He said nothing more. The only sounds were the whir of the heater fan and Ed's chewing. Laying his coat over a chair, Frank collected a handful of half-completed silver segments and carried them to the arbor. He screwed a wool buffing wheel onto the spindle, started up the motor. He dressed the wheel with bobbing compound, put on the mask to protect his eyes, and then, seated on a stool, began removing the fire scale from the segments, one by one. Chapter 15. Captain Rudolf Wegener, at the moment traveling under the cover name Konrad Goltz, a dealer in medical supplies on a wholesale basis, peered through the window of the Lufthansa ME-9-E rocket ship. Europe ahead. How quickly, he thought. We will be landing at Tempelhofer Feld in approximately 7 minutes. I wonder what I accomplished, he thought as he watched the land mass grow. It is up to General Tedecky now. Whatever he can do in the home islands, but at least we got the information to them. We did what we could. He thought, but there is no reason to be optimistic. Probably the Japanese can do nothing to change the course of German internal politics. The Goebbels government is in power and probably will stand. After it is consolidated, it will turn once more to the notion of Dandelion. And another major section of the planet will be destroyed, with its population, for a deranged, fanatic ideal. Suppose eventually they, the Nazis, destroy it all. Leave it a sterile ash. They could. They have the hydrogen bomb. And no doubt they would. Their thinking tends toward that Götterdämmerung. They may well crave it, be actively seeking it, a final holocaust for everyone. And what will that leave, that third world insanity? Will that put an end to all life, of every kind, everywhere? When our planet becomes a dead planet by our own hands? He could not believe that. Even if all life on our planet is destroyed, there must be other life somewhere which we know nothing of. It is impossible that ours is the only world. There must be world after world unseen by us in some region or dimension that we simply do not perceive. Even though I can't prove that, even though it isn't logical, I believe it, he said to himself. A loudspeaker said, Meine Damen und Herren, Achtung bitte! We are approaching the moment of landing, Captain Wegener said to himself. I will almost surely be met by the Sicherheitsdienst. The question is, which faction of policy will be represented, the Goebbels or the Heydrich? Assuming that SS General Heydrich is still alive. While I have been aboard this ship, he could have been rounded up and shot. Things happen fast during the time of transition in a totalitarian society. There have been in Nazi Germany tattered lists of names over which men have pored before. Several minutes later, when the rocket ship had landed, he found himself on his feet, moving toward the exit with his overcoat over his arm. Behind him and ahead of him, anxious passengers. No young Nazi artist this time, he reflected, no Lotze to badger me at the last with his moronic viewpoint. An airline's uniformed official, dressed, Wegener observed, like the Reichsmarschall himself, assisted them all down the ramp one by one to the field. There, by the concourse, stood a small knot of black shirts. For me? Wegener began to walk slowly from the parked rocket ship. Over at another spot, men and women waiting, waving, calling, even some children. One of the black shirts, a flat-faced, unwinking blonde fellow wearing the Waffen-SS insignia, stepped smartly up to Wegener, clicked the heels of his jackboots together, and saluted. Ich bitte mich zu entschuldigen. Sind Sie nicht Kapitän Rudolf Wegener von der Abwehr? Sorry, Wegener answered. I am Konrad Goltz, representing AG Chemikalien Medical Supplies. He started on past. Two other black shirts, Also Waffen SS came toward him. The three of them fell in beside him, so that although he continued on at his own pace, in his own direction, he was quite abruptly and effectively under custody. Two of the Waffen SS men had submachine guns under their greatcoats.
"You are Wegener,"
one of them said as they entered the building. He said nothing.
"We have a car," the Waffen SS man continued. "We are instructed to meet your rocket ship, contact you, and take you immediately to SS General Heydrich, who is with Sepp Dietrich at the OKW of the Leibstandarte Division. In particular, we are not to permit you to be approached by Wehrmacht or Partei persons."
"Then I will not be shot," Wegener said to himself. "Heydrich is alive and in a safe location, and trying to strengthen his position against the Goebbels government. Maybe the Goebbels government will fall after all," he thought as he was ushered into the waiting SS Daimler staff sedan. A detachment of Waffen SS suddenly shifted at night, guards at the Reich Kanzlei relieved, replaced. The Berlin police station suddenly spewing forth armed SD men in every direction, radio stations and power cut off, Tempelhofer closed, rumble of heavy guns in the darkness along main streets. But what does it matter? Even if Dr. Goebbels is deposed and Operation Dandelion is cancelled, they will still exist, the black shirts, the Partei, the schemes, if not in the Orient, then somewhere else, on Mars and Venus. No wonder Mr. Tagomi could not go on, he thought, the terrible dilemma of our lives. Whatever happens, it is evil beyond compare. Why struggle, then? Why choose, if all alternatives are the same? Evidently we go on as we always have, from day to day. At this moment we work against Operation Dandelion. Later on, at another moment, we work to defeat the police. But we cannot do it all at once. It is a sequence, an unfolding process. We can only control the end by making a choice at each step. He thought, we can only hope and try. On some other world, possibly it is different, better. There are clear good and evil alternatives, not these obscure admixtures, these blends, with no proper tool by which to untangle the components. We do not have the ideal world, such as we would like, where morality is easy because cognition is easy, where one can do right with no effort because he can detect the obvious. The Daimler started with Captain Wegener in the back, a black shirt on each side, machine gun on lap. Black shirt behind the wheel. Suppose it is a deception even now, Wegener thought as the sedan moved at high speed through Berlin traffic. They are not taking me to SS General Heydrich at the Leibstandarte Division OKW. They are taking me to a Partei jail, there to maim me and finally kill me. But I have chosen. I chose to return to Germany. I chose to risk capture before I could reach Abwehr people and protection. Death at each moment. One avenue which is open to us at any point. And eventually we choose it, in spite of ourselves. Or we give up and take it deliberately. He watched the Berlin houses pass. My own folk, he thought. You and I. Again, together. To the three SS men, he said, "How are things? Any recent developments in the political situation? I've been away for several weeks, before Bormann's death, in fact." The man to his right answered, "There's naturally plenty of hysterical mob support for the little doctor. It was the mob that swept him into office. However, it's unlikely that when more sober elements prevail, they'll want to support a cripple and demagogue who depends on inflaming the mass with his lies and spellbinding."
"I see," Wegener said. "It goes on," he thought. "The internecine hate. Perhaps the seeds are there in that. They will eat one another at last and leave the rest of us here and there in the world still alive. Still enough of us once more to build and hope and make a few simple plans."
At 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Juliana Frink reached Cheyenne, Wyoming. In the downtown business section, across from the enormous old train depot, she stopped at a cigar store and bought 2 afternoon newspapers. Parked at the curb, she searched until she at last found the item. Vacation ends in fatal slashing. Sought for questioning concerning the fatal slashing of her husband in their swank rooms at the President Garner Hotel in Denver, Mrs. Joe Cinadella of Cannon City, according to hotel employees, left immediately after what must have been the tragic climax of a marital quarrel. Razor blades found in the room, ironically supplied as a convenience by the hotel to its guests, apparently were used by Mrs. Cinadella, described as dark, attractive, well-dressed, and slender, about 30, to slash the throat of her husband, whose body was found by Theodore Ferris, hotel employee who had picked up shirts from Cinadella just half an hour earlier and was returning them as instructed, only to come on to the grisly scene. The hotel suite, police said, showed signs of struggle, suggesting that a violent argument had... So he's dead, Juliana thought as she folded up the newspaper. And not only that, they don't have my name right. They don't know who I am or anything about me. Much less anxious now, she drove on until she found a suitable motel. There she made arrangements for a room and carried her possessions in from the car. From now on, I don't have to hurry, she said to herself. I can even wait until evening to go to the Abinsons. That way I'll be able to wear my new dress. It wouldn't do to show up during the day with it on. You just don't wear a formal dress like that before dinner. And I can finish reading the book. She made herself comfortable in the motel room, turning on the radio, getting coffee from the motel lunch counter. She propped herself up on the neatly made bed with the new, unread, clean copy of The Grasshopper, which she had bought at the hotel bookshop in Denver. At 6:15 in the evening, she finished the book. I wonder if Joe got to the end of it, she wondered. There's so much more in it than he understood. What is it Abinson wanted to say? Nothing about his make-believe world. Am I the only one who knows? I'll bet I am. Nobody else really understands Grasshopper but me. They just imagine they do. Still a little shaky, she put it away in her suitcase, and then put on her coat and left the motel room to search for a place to eat dinner. The air smelled good, and the signs and lights of Cheyenne seemed particularly exciting. In front of a bar, 2 pretty black-eyed Indian prostitutes quarreling, she slowed to watch. Many cars, shiny ones, coasted up and down the streets. The entire spectacle had an aura of brightness and expectancy, of looking ahead to some happy and important event, rather than back. Back, she thought, to the stale and the dreary, the used up and thrown away. At an expensive French restaurant where a man in a white coat parked customers' cars, and each table had a candle burning in a huge wine goblet, and the butter was served not in squares but whipped into round, pale marbles, she ate a dinner which she enjoyed, and then, with plenty of time to spare, strolled back toward her motel. The Reichsbank notes were almost gone, but she did not care. It had no importance. He told us about our own world, she thought, as she unlocked the door to her motel room. This, what's around us now. In the room, she again switched on the radio. He wants us to see it for what it is, and I do, and more so each moment. Taking the blue Italian dress from its carton, she laid it out scrupulously on the bed. It had undergone no damage. All it needed, at most, was a thorough brushing to remove the lint. But when she opened the other parcels, she discovered that she had not brought any of the new half bras from Denver. God damn it, she said, sinking down in a chair. She lit a cigarette and sat smoking for a time. Maybe she could wear it with a regular bra. She slipped off her blouse and skirt and tried the dress on, but the straps of the bra showed, and so did the upper part of each cup, so that would not do. Or maybe, she thought, I can go with no bra at all. It had been years since she had tried that. It recalled to her the old days in high school when she had had a very small bust. She had even worried about it then. But now further maturity and her judo had made her a size 38. However, she tried it without the bra, standing on a chair in the bathroom to view herself in the medicine cabinet mirror. The dress displayed itself stunningly, but good Lord, it was too risky. All she had to do was bend over to put out a cigarette or pick up a drink, and disaster. A pin. She could wear the dress with no bra and collect the front. Dumping the contents of her jewelry box onto the bed, she spread out the pins, relics which she had owned for years, given her by Frank or by other men before their marriage, and the new one which Joe had gotten her in Denver. Yes, a small horse-shaped silver pin from Mexico would do. She found the exact spot. So she could wear the dress after all. I'm glad to get anything now, she thought to herself. So much had gone wrong, so little remained anyhow of the wonderful plans. She did an extensive brushing job on her hair so that it crackled and shone, and that left only the need of a choice of shoes and earrings. And then she put on her new coat, got her new handmade leather purse, and set out. Instead of driving the old Studebaker, she had the motel owner phone for a taxi. While she waited in the motel office, she suddenly had the notion to call Frank. Why it had come to her she could not fathom, but there the idea was. Why not? She asked herself. She could reverse the charges. He would be overwhelmed to hear from her and glad to pay. Standing behind the desk in the office, she held the phone receiver to her ear, listening delightedly to the long-distance operators talk back and forth, trying to make the connection for her. She could hear the San Francisco operator, far off, getting San Francisco information for the number, then many pops and crackles in her ear, and at last the ringing noise itself. As she waited, she watched for the taxi. It should be along any time, she thought. But it won't mind waiting. They expect it. Your party does not answer, the Cheyenne operator told her at last. We will put the call through again later, and no, Juliana said, shaking her head. It had been just a whim, anyhow. I won't be here, thank you. She hung up. The motel owner had been standing nearby to see that nothing would be mistakenly charged to him, and walked quickly out of the office onto the cool, dark sidewalk to stand and wait there. From the traffic, a gleaming new cab coasted up to the curb and halted. The door opened, and the driver hopped out to hurry around. A moment later, Juliana was on her way, riding in luxury in the rear of the cab, across Cheyenne, to the Appensons. The Appenson house was lit up, and she could hear music and voices. It was a single-story stucco house with many shrubs and a good deal of garden made up mostly of climbing roses. As she started up the flagstone path, she thought, can I actually be there? Is this the high castle? What about the rumors and stories? The house was ordinary, well maintained, and the grounds tended. There was even a child's tricycle parked in the long cement driveway. Could it be the wrong Abinson? She had gotten the address from the Cheyenne phone book, but it matched the number she had called the night before from Greeley. She stepped up onto the porch with its wrought iron railings and pressed the buzzer. Through the half-open door she could make out the living room, a number of persons standing about, Venetian blinds on the windows, a piano, fireplace, bookcases, nicely furnished, she thought. A party going on? But they were not formally dressed. A boy, tousled, about 13, wearing a T-shirt and jeans, flung the door wide. Yes? She said, is Mr. Abinson home? Is he busy? Speaking to someone behind him in the house, the boy called, Mom, she wants to see Dad. Beside the boy appeared a woman with reddish-brown hair, possibly 35, with strong, unwinking gray eyes, and a smile so thoroughly competent and remorseless that Juliana knew she was facing Caroline Abbotson.
"I called last night," Juliana said. "Oh, yes, of course," her smile increased. She had perfect, white, regular teeth. Irish, Juliana decided. Only Irish blood could give that jawline such femininity. "Let me take your purse and coat. This is a very good time for you. These are a few friends. What a lovely dress. It's House of Cherubini, isn't it?" She led Juliana across the living room to a bedroom where she laid Juliana's things with the others on the bed. "My husband is around somewhere. Look for a tall man with glasses drinking an old-fashioned." The intelligent light in her eyes poured out to Juliana. Her lips quivered. "There is so much understood between us," Juliana realized. "Isn't that amazing?" "I drove a long way," Juliana said. "Yes, you did. Now I see him." Caroline Abbotson guided her back into the living room toward a group of men. "Dear," she called, "come over here. This is one of your readers who is very anxious to say a few words to you." One man of the group moved, detached, and approached carrying his drink. Juliana saw an immensely tall man with black, curly hair. His skin, too, was dark, and his eyes seemed purple or brown, very softly colored behind his glasses. He wore a hand-tailored, expensive, natural fiber suit, perhaps English wool. The suit augmented his wide, robust shoulders with no lines of its own. In all her life, she had never seen a suit quite like it. She found herself staring in fascination. Caroline said, "Mrs. Frink drove all the way up from Cannon City, Colorado, just to talk to you about Grasshopper." "I thought you lived in a fortress," Juliana said. Bending to regard her, Hawthorne Abbotson smiled a meditative smile.
"Yes, we did. But we had to get up to it in an elevator, and I developed a phobia. I was pretty drunk when I got the phobia, but as I recall it, and they tell it, I refused to stand up in it because I said that the elevator cable was being hauled up by Jesus Christ, and we were going all the way, and I was determined not to stand."
She did not understand. Caroline explained. "Hoth has said as long as I've known him that when he finally sees Christ, he is going to sit down. He's not going to stand." The hymn, Juliana remembered. "So you gave up the high castle and moved back into town," she said.
"I'd like to pour you a drink," Hawthorne said.
"All right," she said, "but not an old-fashioned." She had already got a glimpse of the sideboard with several bottles of whiskey on it, hors d'oeuvres, glasses, ice, mixer, cherries, and orange slices. She walked toward it, Abbotson accompanying her. "Just I.W. Harper over ice," she said. "I always enjoy that. Do you know the Oracle?"
"No,"
Hawthorne said as he fixed her drink for her. Astounded, she said, "The Book of Changes?"
"I don't know," he repeated. He handed her her drink.
Caroline Abbotson said, "Don't tease her." "I read your book," Juliana said. "In fact, I finished it this evening." "How did you know all that? About the other world you wrote about?" Hawthorne said nothing. He rubbed his knuckle against his upper lip, staring past her and frowning. "Did you use the Oracle?" Juliana said. Hawthorne glanced at her. "I don't want you to kid or joke," Juliana said. "Tell me without making something witty out of it." Chewing his lip, Hawthorne gazed down at the floor. He wrapped his arms about himself, rocked back and forth on his heels. The others in the room nearby had become silent, and Juliana noticed that their manner had changed. They were not happy now because of what she had said. But she did not try to take it back or disguise it. She did not pretend. It was too important. And she had come too far and done too much to accept anything less than the truth from him.
"That's a hard question to answer," Abbotson said finally.
"No, it isn't," Juliana said.
Now everyone in the room had become silent. They all watched Juliana standing with Caroline and Hawthorne Abbotson.
"I'm sorry," Abbotson said. "I can't answer right away. You'll have to accept that."
"Then why did you write the book?" Juliana said.
Indicating with his drink glass, Abbotson said, "What's that pin on your dress do? Ward off dangerous anima spirits of the immutable world, or does it just hold everything together?"
"Why do you change the subject?" Juliana said, "evading what I asked you and making a pointless remark like that. It's childish."
Hawthorne Abbotson said, "Everyone has technical secrets. You have yours, I have mine. You should read my book and accept it on face value, just as I accept what I see." Again, he pointed at her with his glass. "Without inquiring if it's genuine underneath, there, or done with wires and staves and foam rubber padding. Isn't that part of trusting in the nature of people and what you see in general?"
He seemed, she thought, irritable and flustered now, no longer polite, no longer a host. And Caroline, she noticed out of the corner of her eye, had an expression of tense exasperation. Her lips were pressed together, and she had stopped smiling entirely. "In your book," Juliana said, "you showed that there's a way out. Isn't that what you meant?"
"Out,"
he echoed ironically. Juliana said, "You've done a lot for me. Now I can see there's nothing to be afraid of, nothing to want or hate or avoid here or run from or pursue." He faced her, jiggling his glass, studying her.
"There's a great deal in this world worth the candle, in my opinion."
"I understand what's going on in your mind," Juliana said. To her it was the old and familiar expression on a man's face, but it did not upset her to see it here. She no longer felt as she once had. "The Gestapo file said you're attracted to women like me."
Abbotson, with only the slightest change of expression, said, "There hasn't been a Gestapo since 1947.
"The SD, then, or whatever it is." "Would you explain?" Caroline said in a brisk voice. "I want to," Juliana said. "I drove up to Denver with one of them. They're going to show up here eventually. You should go someplace they can't find you, instead of holding open house here like this, letting anyone walk in the way I did. The next one who rides up here, there won't be anyone like me to put a stop to him."
"You say the next one," Abbotson said after a pause. "What became of the one you rode up to Denver with? Why won't he show up here?"
She said, "I cut his throat."
"That's quite something," Hawthorne said, "to have a girl tell you that, a girl you never saw before in your life."
"Don't you believe me?"
He nodded. "Sure."
He smiled at her in a shy, gentle, forlorn way. Apparently, it did not even occur to him not to believe her.
"Thanks," he said.
"Please hide from them," she said.
"Well," he said, "we did try that, as you know. As you read on the cover of the book, about all the weapons and charged wire, and we had it written so it would seem we're still taking great precautions."
His voice had a weary, dry tone. "You could at least carry a weapon," his wife said. "I know someday someone you invite in and converse with will shoot you down, some Nazi expert paying you back, and you'll be philosophizing just this way. I foresee it."
"They can get you," Hawthorne said, "if they want to. Charged wire and high castle or not."
"You're so fatalistic," Juliana thought. "Resigned to your own destruction. Do you know that, too, the way you knew the world in your book?" Juliana said, "The Oracle wrote your book, didn't it?"
Hawthorne said, "Do you want the truth?"
"I want it, and I'm entitled to it," she answered, "for what I've done. Isn't that so? You know it's so."
"The Oracle," Abbotson said, was sound asleep all through the writing of the book, sound asleep in the corner of the office. His eyes showed no merriment. Instead, his face seemed longer, more somber than ever.
"Tell her," Caroline said. "She's right. She's entitled to know for what she did on your behalf."
To Juliana, she said,
"I'll tell you then, Mrs. Frank. One by one, Hoth made the choices, thousands of them, by means of the lines. Historic period, subject, characters, plot. It took years. Hoth even asked the Oracle what sort of success it would be. It told him that it would be a very great success, the first real one of his career, so you were right. You must use the Oracle quite a lot yourself to have known."
Juliana said, "I wonder why the Oracle would write a novel. Did you ever think of asking it that? And why one about the Germans and the Japanese losing the war? Why that particular story and no other one? What is there it can't tell us directly like it always has before? This must be different, don't you think?"
Neither Hawthorne nor Caroline said anything. "It and I," Hawthorne said at last, "long ago arrived at an agreement regarding royalties. If I ask it why it wrote Grasshopper, I'll wind up turning my share over to it. The question implies I did nothing but the typing, and that's neither true nor decent."
"I'll ask it," Caroline said, "if you won't."
"It's not your question to ask," Hawthorne said. "Let her ask."
To Juliana, he said,
"You have an unnatural mind. Are you aware of that?"
Juliana said, "Where's your copy? Mine's in my car back at the motel. I'll get it if you won't let me use yours." Turning, Hawthorne started off. She and Caroline followed through the room of people toward a closed door. At the door he left them. When he reemerged, they all saw the black-backed twin volumes.
"I don't use the yarrow stalks," he said to Juliana. "I can't get the hang of them. I keep dropping them."
Juliana seated herself at a coffee table in the corner. "I have to have paper to write on and a pencil." One of the guests brought her paper and pencil. The people in the room moved in to form a ring around her and the Abinsons, listening and watching.
"You may say the question aloud," Hawthorne said. "We have no secrets here."
Juliana said,
"Oracle, why did you write The Grasshopper Lies Heavy? What are we supposed to learn?"
"You have a disconcertingly superstitious way of phrasing your question," Hawthorne said. But he had squatted down to witness the coin throwing. "Go ahead," he said. He handed her three Chinese brass coins with holes in the center. "I generally use these."
She began throwing the coins. She felt calm and very much herself. Hawthorne wrote down her lines for her. When she had thrown the coins six times, he gazed down and said,
"Sun at the top, twi at the bottom, empty in the center."
"Do you know what hexagram that is?" she said, "without using the chart?"
"Yes,"
Hawthorne said. "It's Zhong Fu," Juliana said. "Inner truth. I know without using the chart, too, and I know what it means."
Raising his head, Hawthorne scrutinized her.
He had now an almost savage expression. "It means, does it, that my book is true?"
"Yes," she said.
With anger, he said, "Germany and Japan lost the war."
"Yes."
Hawthorne then closed the two volumes and rose to his feet. He said nothing.
"Even you don't face it," Juliana said.
For a time he considered. His gaze had become empty, Juliana saw. Turned inward, she realized. Preoccupied by himself. And then his eyes became clear again. He grunted, started.
"I'm not sure of anything," he said.
"Believe," Juliana said.
He shook his head no.
can't you?" she said. "Are you sure?"
Hawthorne Abinson said, "Do you want me to autograph a copy of The Grasshopper for you?"
She too rose to her feet. "I think I'll go," she said. "Thank you very much. I'm sorry if I disrupted your evening. It was kind of you to let me in." Going past him and Caroline, she made her way through the ring of people from the living room and into the bedroom where her coat and purse were. As she was putting her coat on, Hawthorne appeared behind her.
"Do you know what you are?"
He turned to Caroline, who stood beside him.
"This girl is a demon. A little chthonic spirit that..."
He lifted his hand and rubbed his eyebrow, partially dislodging his glasses in doing so.
"That roams tirelessly over the face of the earth."
He restored his glasses in place.
"She's doing what's instinctive to her, simply expressing her being. She didn't mean to show up here and do harm. It simply happened to her, just as the weather happens to us. I'm glad she came. I'm not sorry to find this out, this revelation she's had through the book. She didn't know what she was going to do here or find out. I think we're all of us lucky. So let's not be angry about it, okay?"
Caroline said, "She's terribly, terribly disruptive."
"So is reality,"
Hawthorne said. He held out his hand to Juliana.
"Thank you for what you did in Denver," he said.
She shook hands with him. "Good night," she said. "Do as your wife says, carry a hand weapon, at least."
"No," he said. "I decided that a long time ago. I'm not going to let it bother me. I can lean on the Oracle now and then if I do get edgy, late at night in particular. It's not bad in such a situation."
He smiled a little.
"Actually, the only thing that bothers me anymore is knowing that all these bums standing around here listening and taking in everything are drinking up all the liquor in the house while we're talking."
Turning, he strode away back to the sideboard to find fresh ice for his drink. "Where are you going now that you've finished here?" Caroline said. "I don't know." The problem did not bother her. "I must be a little like him," she thought. "I won't let certain things worry me, no matter how important they are. Maybe I'll go back to my husband, Frank. I tried to phone him tonight. I might try again. I'll see how I feel later on." "Despite what you did for us, or what you say you did..." "You wish I had never come into this house," Juliana said. "If you saved Hawthorne's life, it's dreadful of me, but I'm so upset I can't take it all in, what you've said and Hawthorne has said." "How strange," Juliana said. "I never would have thought the truth would make you angry." Truth, she thought, as terrible as death, but harder to find. "I'm lucky. I thought you'd be as pleased and excited as I am. It's a misunderstanding, isn't it?" She smiled, and after a pause, Mrs. Abinson managed to smile back. "Well, good night anyhow." A moment later, Juliana was retracing her steps back down the flagstone path, into the patches of light from the living room, and then into the shadows beyond the lawn of the house, onto the black sidewalk. She walked on without looking again at the Abinson house, and, as she walked, searching up and down the streets for a cab or a car, moving and bright and living, to take her back to her motel.
The end. You've been listening to The Man in the High Castle, by Philip K. Dick, narrated by George Guidel. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Martin Dressler by Stephen Milhauser, also narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800 638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.